There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Well, we heard a couple of weeks ago about how a shortage of mineral resources might be the real crisis we face in the future alongside climate change, but perhaps the impacts will be felt quicker. We've already seen supply shortages from COVID disruption, but is this just a foretaste of what's to come? And how do we adapt to a future where anything that is resource intensive is very expensive and still keep the economy running? That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Well, one of the outcomes of COVID-19 has been supply shortages and labour shortages. That is certainly being experienced here in the UK. It's meant prices are being pushed higher, labour costs are increasing, demand might be coming back, but supply is extremely constrained in Britain. You can then add the impact of Brexit to those supply concerns. The number of large trucks, for example, heading into Dover in the first 5 months of this year are 15% down on last year, 27% down on the year before. So you can see how stuff just isn't wheeling its way in and out of the country. But that's all Brexit and COVID. What if supply falls more permanently? Because as we discussed a couple of weeks ago on this podcast, resources become more scarce. For example, Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing, TSMC, the world's second largest, or actually maybe the largest maker of semiconductors, is planning to increase prices by 10 to 20%, according to a Wall Street Journal report this week, simply because of the difficulties in getting the materials that they need. So, Steve, we were in a low inflation environment before the pandemic. Surely if we've got shortages of supply, short-term and long-term, but we've still got that demand there, then that's prices can only rise, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things which I'm going to have. Obviously, the supply prices go through the roof. If it's simply physically costing you more to produce it, then you've got to, as a producer, you've got to put a markup on that price that enables you to at least have a possibility of selling it for a profit. But the drawback for that is that, and this is where economic theory is as usual completely misleading. When you have a fall in your supply capacity because some essential resource is not coming in, your costs of production go up substantially for two reasons. One is the volume, also three, you're paying more for the input, so bang up go your input prices. Possibly even more importantly, the volume you can put through your factory falls, and because fixed costs are far and away the largest cost, particularly things like semiconductors. I mean, the cost of a semiconductor factory is measured in the billions of dollars. Okay, so the fixed costs are enormous, and because you're amortizing those fixed costs over a smaller level of output, then your per unit costs also rise just because of the increase in fixed costs. So you've got increased supply costs, you've got increased fixed costs per unit, and your productivity, neoclassicals have this crazy idea that your marginal productivity falls with rising output, so your costs rise. The exact opposite is the rule in normal factories, because they're designed to be most efficient at full capacity. As you reduce it, as you're forced to reduce your output level below capacity, the cost per unit, variable cost per unit, also rises. So everything is driving up price, driving up costs. And then if you're doing what virtually all manufacturers do, and that's markup pricing, you have a cost level predominantly determined in most industries by your wages, and then you mark up on top of that. That tendency means you're just going to simply going to be forced to pass on the prices. But then what happens, this is the tricky bit, is this a sustained push for inflation, or is it going to mean your demand collapses? And that's the part that I, you know, I'm still scratching my own head over.
It's finding its level, isn't it, really? Because if there's a shortage of supply and you can't produce as much, then there's not going to be as great a demand. So higher prices are, I mean, as you're saying, a lot of it will be sort of driven by the cost, which will increase because of costs along the supply chain. But there'll also be an element, won't there, of just charging what you can get away with. If you're producing something and a lot of people want it and there's not many of them, then you can go, well, okay, I'm just going to give it to whoever's going to pay the most for it.
The question is whether there's enough of those for you to be profitable. I saw an interesting when you're looking at the, you know, my this is my Elon Musk fanboy stuff, checking out the costs of the solar city, the roof tiles that a spin-off from Tesla produces, that are both roof tiles and solar collectors. And they said that their costs were higher because the volume of sales was lower. Now, if this keeps on going backwards, it gets to a point where you simply can no longer price it at a level that it's a mass consumption item. The only people who can afford it are the uber wealthy. And then a whole lot of stuff which was once mass market and was tending further towards mass market becomes niche and the thing is, at that level, a lot of the firms producing it are going to go bankrupt.
But we are producing too much anyway. I mean, that was the discussion we were having a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it? So maybe we need to go through this. I mean, we don't want to go through this to the stage where anything which is worth anything at all only goes to the rich people. There needs to be a way that it can be managed through all of society. But maybe this is the hurt we need to feel, that we consume less, so therefore we produce less. And companies will go to the wall, but that's what you expect if we're a society which is over-consuming, or at least over-consuming stuff. I mean, we can consume services which aren't necessarily putting pressure on the environment, but actually physical stuff. We need to make less of it. So isn't that a good thing?
No. it's a good thing in terms of, yes, this will finally mean that we respond to the damage we've done to the environment thus far. The thing is that the response could mean that society collapses completely and we go back to banging a couple of rocks together, preferably on the head of the person next door has got more stuff than you've got. So that what
we weren't worried about global warming in those days, though, yeah. You know? We're worried about survival, but global warming wasn't on their agenda for cavemen.
This is Tim Garrett's work. If you look at my friend and colleague Tim Garrett, who's coming at economics from a thermodynamics and atmospheric physics point of view, his argument has been that we inevitably, the more energy we access or can access, the more we'll use, we'll drive ourselves into a crisis, and then we'll collapse from that. So we're back to the level where we're just the same as the other animals, in the sense that all we're able to exploit is the energy, the flow coming from the sun, picked up by those solar collectors called plants and processed by those coal factories called animals, as much as we can manage to catch them. In other words, we can have a return to a Stone Age coming out of this. And I think that's a terrifying thought, both in terms of humanity, you know, humans themselves and what they experience, but also the knowledge we'll lose. And this is the scary. It is not a good thing. And the whole, like, in many ways, and this is one of the ironies, the whole limits to growth movement is interpreted as being anti, the way the neoclassicals talked about it, you know, anti-human, sophisticated society, anti-consumption, anti-progress. No, it was the only way to be able to maintain progress for the long future. And we've completely ruined that guidance. And now we may be facing the consequences that the option we face is a Stone Age one.
I've just come back from a week's holiday in Cornwall, and I stayed in a town that had just in Newquay, which had just held the what's called the Boardmasters Festival, which is a surfing and music festival, one of the many super spreader events that you can take part in the UK. And so Newquay for a while had last week, basically while I was there, I think had one of the highest COVID rates in the country. Consequently, eating out was impossible because lots of restaurants were closed because they couldn't get the staff. There were supply shortages, and we heard in the UK how McDonald's can't get milkshakes, for example, because of supply shortages. So basically, we ate out for lunch one day, but that was all we managed. Everything else was just impossible to find a restaurant which was either open or had space for you. So there we were, adjusting to a new normal, as was everybody else. We were being less consumerist. We spent less money. We did less help for the local economy. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, this is a sign of where we're heading.
It could be. And I think it is. Unfortunately, I think it is the sign of where we're heading, because the scale of climate breakdown that we face is beyond... as I saw someone writing on Twitter a while ago, you can't think science to understand or to comprehend what it might mean. You've got to think science fiction. And I'm a great fan of Kim Stanley Robinson, who wrote the Moving Mars series, or the Greening Mars, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars series, which I thought was superb. And I'm sure they're some of the books that inspired Elon Musk and his, you know, colonized Mars ambitions as well. I'm no great fan of the last book, which is called Ministry for the Future, because it cops out. It basically says, "Oh, we solve it all using international bureaucracy." Well, I mean, that's more fiction than fiction, frankly.
One world government sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, the Ministry for the Future comes along, and we managed to do this, we managed to do that, and thank God we escaped through the end. And I would have preferred, and I told the, I was actually going to suggest we interview him on this program. We might still try doing it. But I would have preferred to see a sliding doors ending. You know, one way we manage to survive it by doing all the right thing, the other thing, everything goes wrong and we collapse. But the opening point that the opening chapter, which is very much worth reading, and I think you can find that on the internet as well. You know, buying the book was a good idea, not as good as buying Red Mars, or Green Mars, Blue Mars, but still, you know, worth supporting a very decent and far-thinking author. But in that opening chapter, what he has is a wet bulb catastrophe taking place, I think, in northern India. And an entire city, everybody dies. I mean, you're talking, you know, like a Indian city, 10, 15 million people, everybody dies. And that then provokes India into rogue seeding of the atmosphere to reduce temperatures. And then you have this ministry being formed so that it's an internationally coordinated effort to try to reverse the damage we've done. And, you know, we all end up living happily ever after at the end of the book, which is the part I think is, you know, just naive, unfortunately, given how bright the opening, or bright and terrifying the opening was. But yeah, it's something of that scale. And only, I think, when that happens, I mean, not when you lose like a German village and 200 people die, but when something on a scale that wipes out a city or a country, then we'll realize, holy shit, this is serious. And I don't think we're going to do anything up to that point. And then the question is, well, if that happens, what could happen to agricultural production if, for example, a set of storms wipe out the agricultural Europe.
We get more scarcity, exactly. And even without climate warming, that's what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yeah,
about the scarcity of resources, independent of climate change. Obviously, the two are very linked. And is that going to keep on pushing prices up? Are we going to get inflation because of this shortage of supply, which is what we were talking about just a few moments ago? And that is a difficult environment for central banks. I mean, there's no role for monetary policy in all of this, is it? Because it proves it is just inept at dealing with this. Because we're going to have rising inflation driven by supply. If they go, oh my goodness, we've got inflation, we better push up interest rates. That's not going to slow that impact. That is the wrong weapon for the problem.
Well, it'll actually, again, that's the point. It'll bankrupt the companies that are already, you know, if you have companies which are carrying some debt, and we've got the highest level of corporate debt in human history right now, carrying some debt, and then you have a collapse in supply, which means they have to put their prices up because they're paying more for the inputs. And then having done that, their demand is insufficient, so they're losing money. And then if you say, we're going to charge you more interest on your debt, well, bang, that's just going to accelerate bankruptcy, shut the doors.
Yeah.
And
so there's nothing
and
they can
then,
do. Yeah. There's nothing they can do to solve this problem then.
If we, not from a monetary, no, not monetary policy, forget it, not going to do it. Yeah.
And then at the same time, we might start looking at this, although we're not, interestingly, and say, well, my goodness, prices are getting higher. I could borrow more because there's low interest rates. We've got higher inflation. Things are becoming more expensive. What a great time to borrow, because it's like free money, because if we've got inflation, then actually, you know, over time, then the value of my debt is going to decrease. And anyway, I'm paying low interest rates. And, you know, perhaps in real terms, it is like free money. If the consumer was to look at that rationally, they might be thinking like that. But they're not, because they're borrowing less, because they're worried about the future.
Well, that is rational. That is rational to worry about the future.
Future, yeah.
There's neoclassical rational not to worry about the future because you already know what's going to happen. But in the real world, one of my favourite lines from the Doors song is the future's uncertain and the end is always near.
Yeah.
Not that I can do Jim Morrison, but that's the basic reality. The future's uncertain. But if your certainty is that there's a collapse of production, then the last thing you're going to be doing in that environment of collapsing demand is take on more debt, because the only way you're going to service the debt is you have a cash flow out of the way you employ the money you've borrowed, and that isn't going to happen. So you can have a collapsing credit-based demand at the same time. And all this stuff, the only way you're going to sustain anything is government money creation.
Yeah. Well, that is the only way out, isn't it? Because if you look at that situation I gave in Newquay, where we couldn't get anywhere to eat out, we had money in our pocket to spend that was going to keep people in jobs. Those people weren't, you know, the money wasn't going into those companies that were paying the people to work in those restaurants. The Resolution Foundation has said the benefits of COVID has been, one of them has been that lower paid workers have now got more bargaining power because there's fewer people than there are jobs currently, so there's a shortage of labour. But I mean, I think that's only temporary, isn't it? I think the long term picture is going to be that the lower income workers are the ones who long term are going to lose their jobs through all of this, and the only people who can afford the stuff that is really needed, as you said before, are going to be the rich. So the rich are going to be the people who feel it least. So we're going to get a wider divide in society. So the government policy's got to be across all of this, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has to be, and that that's actually one reason to be thankful that MMT has started to permeate intellectual and policy circles these days. Because when you realise you're going to have to, you know, generate a large amount of fiat money to keep cash flow such that firms can remain. Have their doors open, but remain to having some level of profitability so they can continue functioning, then the fact that the government can create that, you know, in domestic currency indefinitely, and it isn't you know, going to mean that we're going to, oh dear, we monetarily survive the crisis, and then because of that we die because of a monetary crisis for our kids. That's not going to happen. So there's at least the positive that we realise that it's possible, in a sense, to finance this as we finance the Second World War, which is by creating the money necessary. And then that provides the cash flow that means the companies that aren't able to sell what they used to sell before the war can sell what they can during the war to the government. Back then it was dropping bombs on the Germans and the Nazis. Now it's going to be trying to rapidly decarbonize the economy.
If that is placing demand, if that is adding to the demand that wouldn't be there otherwise, this government money is putting money in people's pockets and then they're using it to consume, and they will be using it to consume those resources that, again, you know, we were talking about in a couple of weeks are going to be in short supply, like, you know, the components needed for microchips, for example. The more we use complicated technology in cars, for example, the more those microchips are needed, the more money we have, the more we demand it.
And the more rationing we need as a result, and this is the other side. Again, I think we really have to look back at what we forgot from the Second World War was, as well as having a mobilisation to attack the direct problem of the, you know, if you don't mobilise properly, you're going to have to learn how to do the Heil Hitler salute. that as well was matched by rationing. So you'd simply, you know, you had to eat chicory rather than coffee, for example. The tea, so much for tea, because you couldn't import tea anymore because that was Sri Lanka too far away. So what you had to do was take demand out of the private sector, which is what selling war bonds was all about, not financing the war, but meaning that the consumer economy had its money locked up in bonds and therefore couldn't buy all that much. And that was the deliberate intent of those war bonds. So a similar thing now, we'd have to have government money creation and rationing at the same time and do it in such a way that it's accepted as being fair. Because if it's not accepted as being fair, then you have social breakdown.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, doesn't price act as the rationing factor? If you've only got a certain amount of something, then I mean, it doesn't help the poor people, but the rich will just buy whatever they can afford and will control demand that way.
Well, it's
not a healthy future because there'll be a lot of people doing without, but I mean that would be the way the economy would figure it out, isn't it?
That's one way we'd figure it out, but the trouble is that if you then are paying people a dying wage, which is what would be the case, then, when that starts happening, you get, variations on the Arab Spring coming your way, people revolt.
Yeah.
And you challenge the system. It works in a textbook piece of paper. But politically, it would lead to social breakdown.
Well, yeah.
So you can't do it that way.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't have an Arab Spring, though, because you wouldn't be able to send the messages on mobile phones because the poor people who are going to revolt wouldn't be able to afford a mobile phone. Maybe that's the way it'll figure itself out. But, I mean, it's all about consumerism, isn't it? The more we spend, the better the economy, we're told. And it's been very aspirational in the past. We like to show off our wealth with expensive cars, big houses, flash clothes. And it's always been thus, hasn't it? Although, actually, after the Great Depression, apparently, we were a little less focused on the prestige of being wealthy and consumerist because, it was a bit of a dirty word. But that didn't last. That didn't last long. But I wonder, so, you know, this is conspicuous consumption, isn't it? Demand things to signal our social status. I sort of sense that maybe we are reaching the end of that now. And we are now, this is, what was Thorsten Veblen, wasn't he, with the guy who came up with, his argument was, if products were overvalued because of the status they provided, then limit production would limit employment. And therefore, sort of conspicuous consumption was a bad thing because you were limiting supply to try and add value to something, and therefore you were employing less people, so that was a bad thing. Which is a bit like now, the same thing happening because we're running out of materials. But I wonder whether we're over the age of conspicuous consumption anyway. And actually, now we do want to consume less. The question is, what do we do with our money? If you've got money, what do you do? And I think you probably invest it in experiences, which are probably better for the planet than buying stuff.
Well, I mean, what you're going to, if we do start facing, let's just put a hypothetical here. If we do start facing massive collapses in the capacity to supply essential products for the manufacturing processes that sustain our current lifestyles, then you are going to have rationing, which means that the diversity of products we currently experience has to be dramatically reduced. And when we went shopping a couple of days ago for the first time in 3 months because of the COVID outbreak here, and you walk past the cosmetic section and there's 40 brands of shampoo. And in this situation, it comes down that you have one brand of shampoo, one brand of conditioner, if we indeed make conditioner. You just drastically reduce the variety and reduce the amount of energy and effort going into producing a wide range of consumer goods just to provide enough for the people to survive.
But then
you go through this.
Right. Yeah. But then you are saying, well, okay, we're getting rid of competition in doing that. You are. Yeah. It's a state-controlled economy in effect,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, that was again the Second World War.
Mm.
I mean, there was a state-controlled economy. You had General Motors was making tanks, not cars, and the whole idea of the war bonds again was to reduce the demand for cars so that more of the money would go into making tanks. And a similar thing this time. You want a minimal level of demand for the variety that used to exist beforehand, you end up having the state saying everything we're doing is going towards climate change, and then we provide the minimal need to produce the commodities which we need on a sort of flow basis, you know, the food, electricity, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas the stock goods we build, things which last for some length of time, like cars and so on, you know, you reduce yourself to a trivial number of manufacturers, a trivial number of a volume of cars coming out of them, and you enhance your repair effort where that's feasible.
Mm.
You know, or in the case we'd be retooling all this stuff, or saying, well, forget about cars, it's going to be public transport or bicycles. So it's a world, rationing is inevitable in that sort of world. And in that situation, the price system, even though you're going to have inflation, the price system becomes irrelevant. And a major factor, in the Second World War, was trying to constrain demand to stop inflation occurring. And they were successful at that. There wasn't a large amount of inflation in the Second World War.
Yeah. Well, so do you think we are going to be stuck with inflation? I mean, we spoke before the pandemic, and you were, you know, we were talking about, because we've been doing this podcast for that long. Yes.
Mm.
For several years before the pandemic, actually. And, you know, we were talking a lot about the dangers of low inflation and how we were stuck in a low inflation environment. Do you think that is still the case? Or do you think this whole thing about supply means that... there's two issues, aren't there? There's the temporary supply issues, which are related to COVID, and that they, you know, and this is where the central bank speakers are all there saying it's transitory, and they've probably got a point on that. If there's a shortage of supplies for some things for a short period of time, then you're going to reach a peak, but then as supply picks up again, that inflation is going to drop down. You're not going to have sustained rises in prices that's going to push up inflation. So in that environment, perhaps you would go back to that low inflation environment that we were in before. But if we've got big issues, that there's an ongoing shortage of supply that is not to do with COVID, or maybe COVID continues to play an important part of our life, so it's part of the mix, but it's actually accessing the minerals we need, like, for example, for computer chips, then which is becoming an increasingly important part of everything we consume, then you could see inflation would become, you know, something we live with for a lot longer. And that low inflation environment that you're talking about perhaps isn't going to come back.
Or the price system becomes less relevant and you go to rationing.
Yeah.
And then the ration firms are provided with a cash flow generated by the government to enable them to produce the amount that you produce. And most of those chips go towards what's necessary for decarbonizing the economy rather than, you know, consumer desires to have a faster Nintendo device.
Mm. Yeah, we're not going to be very happy about that, though, are we? But, I mean, I guess the rationing, I mean, there's one thing, it's going to force us to recycle, isn't it? If we're told, well, you can't have a new computer chip unless you give us your old one back, you can do that sort of thing, which might actually help the environment.
Or you get to the point where, you know, what your computer you've got is the computer you're going to have for the future, unless you can prove it's broken down, in which case you can go and buy a replacement. And here's the limited range of machines that are available. And you better be careful about what you spend your money on, because if you spend too much on that, you won't have enough for the other essential things. Again, one thing about rationing is to make sure everybody gets enough at least to survive.
This sounds like the worst of Soviet Russia. It's like, if you've got a car, you're stuck with it. There's going to be no, and we know what happens there. There's absolutely no innovation because there's no incentive for innovation. And innovation could actually make things more efficient, but there'd be no one there doing that stuff. We'd all be, looking navel gazing and saying, wasn't it better in the olden days before we had to queue for everything?
Well, so I think you still have innovation because, the innovation we need now is ways to rapidly decarbonize the economy, and that's where the effort would go. And the amount of innovation during the Second World War, and particularly, you know, in the military, but, you know, the dramatic levels of innovation at that point, because you need it, otherwise you're going to lose the war. And exactly the same thing applies here. We'd need to have, again, a large amount of resources being devoted to innovation, but this would be government-funded rather than individual firms trying to profit out of it.
So there's an argument, isn't there, when you hear old people talking about young people about how they need to manage their expectations. You know, they've got this expectation that they're going to live in a big house and have expensive cars, and it wasn't like that when we were young, you know, because we had cars that kept on breaking down. I can't remember how many times my car broke down when I was a young lad in his 20s. But, you know, now you don't think about those things. And, you know, they're saying everyone's expecting bigger houses, which actually isn't true. The peak for housing in the UK was in the 1970s. It was 83 square metres, which isn't very big. But that was the size of UK houses. Now it's down to 67.8 square metres, which is lower than it was in the 1930s. And it's been gradually declining since the 1970s because, obviously, there's more people, there's more higher density housing. But our expectations have fallen over that time in terms of what we expect.
You know, your price levels have risen over that time, and they've reduced the size of the house to make it affordable. That's what's going on.
Yeah, but our expectation for what we're going to get for the price, not for the price, but our expectation of our living has declined because of the rising prices. So I wonder whether and that has been quite gradual to almost the point where nobody notices or even talks about it. But I wonder whether that's actually what's going to happen. We are going to find things are just gradually getting more expensive, including housing. When we're talking about things that you actually consume, stuff, not experiences, that they're just going to get more expensive as the shortage. Just as there's a shortage of land, there becomes a shortage of resources. Prices start to peak, and we just lower our expectations and our consumption. That would be a less disastrous way, without rationing or queuing. That could be a more gradual way to reach that future, couldn't it?
Except that, again, I mean, it means, you know, the poor starve because their wage falls below their cost of subsistence. And this is one reason, again, why I just think it's going to be rationing. If we have, and that's why, again, in that sense, inflation isn't the worry. It's the fact we're going to have to ration consumption to cope with this when you start getting a breakdown caused by climate catastrophes. And therefore, you know, the inflation will be transitory in the sense that there won't be a price system after a while.
So what replaces is a price system? Well, government-issued pricing?
Strict rationing.
Right. Okay.
So it doesn't matter,
there's no price on it. Here's a voucher, you just use it. Is that what we're saying?
That was what was happening in the Second World War. I mean,
buying from a government-controlled... So you really are talking out-and-out communism, aren't you?
Except the communism is supposed to be bountiful, which is, what, of course, not what happened. But no, you're talking a war economy, okay? And a war economy, you want is all your resources to go to the war effort, just enough to keep the populace that's not actually on the front line back at home alive. Their main role is to provide the machinery that's necessary for the combat effort. And you just give them enough to be able to stay alive and do that, and you motivate them so that they accept the sacrifices, because they know if they don't accept the sacrifices, they're going to have a foreign horde come in and rape and pillage. And in a fundamental sense, that's the analogy for climate change. But it won't be accepted by the public on any scale, and it certainly won't be accepted by policymakers until we get genuine catastrophes. Now, I've got some good news for you, though. You're going to be pleased about this. Good news is that won't happen until temperatures have risen by 17.68 degrees Celsius.
Oh, all right then.
Yeah, and I've got this on firm authority. Firm authority, of course, being an economics paper that's just come out, which is what's wasted my time for the last... 17.68. I mean, you've got to get this right. You know, let's not be inaccurate here. So the catastrophic temperature, where our willingness to pay to avoid catastrophe is 17.68 degrees Celsius. That's in this paper, and it's derived in a very mathematical and very, very sophisticated way. I'll quote the footnote that's involved. This is a paper by Dietz and Wagner and two other people. The catastrophic warming temperature is derived from the assumption that economic losses rise quadratically and are calibrated to a loss of 2% at 2.5 degrees warming. So, it only takes 17.68 degrees increase until there's zero economy left.
Right. If the temperature does rise by 17 point whatever degrees, there will be no economy. I mean, they're right about that.
There'll be no life forms.
Yeah, exactly. So let me give a slightly more optimistic outlook.
Oh, no, don't ruin the theme. Okay.
So imagine if we do have this scarcity of resources and it does push up prices because there's less of it around. And that means that, rich people can afford it much more easily than poor people. There'll be things that poor people just can't afford to buy, but there will also be ways that they try and stretch it as far as they can so that the market is as broad as possible. So then what does everyone do for their money? All those people who, the rich people might be owning the factories that are making this stuff. What are the poor people doing? Well, just as we had conspicuous consumption, now we've got inconspicuous consumption. So rich people now aren't spending money on flash things that you can see. They're spending their money on better health funds and better education for their kids or for themselves, sort of educating themselves or going out and having experiences. And all of those are very labor intensive industries. So the poor people will be serving the rich people in this inconspicuous consumption age, which will be less resource dependent. And maybe we just see that the economy just switches more to a leisure-based type economy where the rich people are saying, yes, I have a massage twice a day now because I keep two people employed. I don't really need a massage twice a day, but, that keeps them working and, God, I feel good because of it. And that becomes the future, which is us doing stuff that doesn't depend on consumption. We're still keeping the economy going. We're still paying people, but we're using less resources.
I think you got a Phil W. original there. Inconspicuous consumption. That is a very nice line. So I'd work on that one, mate. Again, I'll come back to a war analogy. One thing which happened during the Second World War was that the royalty stopped wearing the accoutrements of the ruling class and started wearing ordinary clothes to show they were in it together and they were also doing a sacrifice. So in that sense, the conspicuous consumption of the royal family during the Second World War flipped over to being inconspicuous consumption because they wanted to show we're all in this together.
Yeah, but my point is not just about, showing, it's just actually how you're spending your money. And if it's expensive to buy stuff that is resource hungry. Well, I'll give you an example. So, on our holiday this last week, we spent one day in an old slate quarry in Cornwall where you could climb. We climbed the cliff walls and then there was a zip line at the end of it. It was a good day out. Kids loved it. I was terrified and exhausted. But it was, an example of spending time and money that was helping the economy. It was keeping all those people employed. It wasn't particularly resource hungry. And that is a better way. And I could have been using that money instead to buy a flash car, saving up to buy a flash car. But, maybe flash cars will be just so expensive that we don't do that and we just spend more leisure time doing other stuff. And the economy adjusts accordingly.
And I think that's feasible. I mean, because they're simply...
We're all better for it.
One of the interesting ironies during the Second World War is that people's health improved dramatically. And this is partly where the butter versus margarine stuff came in the early days. But it turned out that it was a lower stress level because it's actually the anticipation of a crisis which causes stress. Once you're in the crisis, you've got to manage it. And in fact, stress levels dropped. So people, the health records like heart attacks and stuff declined quite radically. And of course, if you're going to do entertainment, you couldn't, hop in the car and drive down to the Ritz and take the whole family out for a big dinner and a bash up and go watch the fireworks afterwards. You had to go walking in the countryside. This sort of stuff could cause a dramatic level in our consumption. And the question is, how much of what we consume is actually necessary for survival? And it may be of the order of, certainly in the wealthy societies, the Anglo-Saxons 10, and the 10%. Japanese. Could be 10%. I don't know. But it's certainly less than half of what we currently consume. A huge part of what we all do, and especially the rich, of course, comes down to conspicuous consumption.
Yeah. Well, I just wondered, so that isn't that a healthier outlook to the future, that we just change our consumption habits and we use less stuff and we spend more time doing stuff. And we could keep the economy ticking over with that. And I think because you would, rather than poor people working in factories, the less well-off would be working in these service industries where they've got that face-to-face connection with the people consuming their products, which are services, and they are going to get better paid because of that, I think, because they'll be looking at them face-to-face and saying, you've just given me, a good time in whatever way that might be. I wasn't meaning anything like that.
We're not going to have a happy ending in this podcast.
Exactly. Let's leave it on that. We'll leave on a happy ending. But with a happy ending, you always leave a big tip. Maybe that's where...
I'm not going to touch that with a barge pole. Okay.
That's what she said. All right. Catch you next.
Okay.
I'll catch you next week, Steve.
Bye.
Definitely the point to leave that one. Look, next week we're going to look at China. One of our listeners asked, what was the story now in terms of China's private sector debt, which Steve had previously said was, the foretaste of a crisis. Well, he's changed his tune on that. And we'll also look at what's happening with a more authoritarian China. Could we see less trade with the West? And how's that going to change the global community? We'll look at all of that next week on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Back then. Thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.